Welcome to Sustainability Bridges, a EuroSif podcast that aims to build bridges between policymakers, investors, academics, and civil society around the theme of sustainable investment. EuroSif, the European Sustainable Investment Forum, is the leading pan-European association promoting sustainable finance and investment at the European level. In these podcasts, EuroSif's Executive Director invites distinguished guests for a 30-minute conversation on current events shaping the sustainable investment community.
Hello everyone, my name is Aleksandra Palińska and I am the Executive Director of EuroSif. For this episode of Sustainability Bridges, I am honored to be joined by Mr. Will Martindale, Co-Head of Sustainability at Cardano, a Risk and Investment Specialist and Head of Sustainability at Now Pensions. Will has more than a decade of experience in sustainable finance, and prior to joining Cardano, he was Director of Policy and Research at the Principles for Responsible Investment, PRI. Will also has a background in banking, previously working for JP Morgan and BNP Paribas. Together, we are going to discuss the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, SFDR, the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, and the evolution of the Sustainable Finance Regulatory Framework in the EU and beyond. Dear Will, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
To start with, could you please tell us about Cardano and how sustainability considerations are incorporated in your investments?
I can. So Cardano is a UK and Dutch fiduciary manager, asset manager and advisor. We've been going for around 20 years and we invest on behalf of a range of European, Dutch and UK, predominantly pension schemes, but a few other asset owners as well. We've got a high conviction approach to sustainability, at least we'd like to think so. We've incorporated the concepts of transitions in how we define our investment strategies, in particular around social foundations. We want to make sure that the companies in which we invest are conforming to concepts such as social license to operate and ensuring their contributions to a fairer society, as well as environmental transitions, of course, the climate transition, but also transitions associated with biodiversity, land use, water use, and the circular economy. Now, we think that we've got two primary levers, the way in which we invest, but then also the way in which we engage. And engagement is a really important part of how we interpret our sustainability ambitions. We've been leading a number of engagements across environmental and social topics. In particular, we're comfortable using shareholder resolution processes. So really trying to encourage companies, or if they're reluctant to respond to us, then using the full suite of tools that we've got available, including shareholder resolutions, voting and other forms of escalation.
Great, thank you. From the perspective of an asset management firm, could you please share with us what are the main challenges fund managers face when making investment decisions, especially while wishing to invest sustainably?
So I think the primary challenge, and is one that we shouldn't shy away from, is that real economy policymaking is simply inconsistent with our long-term sustainability objectives. Now, we're trying to invest in more sustainable portfolios, but ultimately our portfolios are by and large a reflection of the real economy into which we invest. If that real economy is not decarbonizing or not respecting minimum social foundations, then that makes our investment challenges that much more real. Now, there are a range of other challenges that I'm sure you and your members discuss on a regular basis, such as complexity around new forms of regulation, the breadth of and depth of new reporting obligations, sometimes contradictory views around how we think about responsible investment and the levers that responsible investment has in order to achieve sustainability outcomes. But yeah, just to sort of, you know, repeat the start of my answer here, that the biggest fundamental challenge we've got is that the real economy is not yet transitioning at the pace it needs to.
Thank you for these useful insights. You've mentioned the ESG data. Indeed, would you also see, I would say, insufficient availability or some challenges connected to actually obtaining sustainability-related disclosures on the investee companies as one of the challenges that asset managers face?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a range of issues with data that it's worth unpacking. So The first is availability of data, which your question alludes to. So you're right that we do have challenges around obtaining particularly Scope 3 emissions data when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions reporting. That's particularly the case outside of the UK and Europe. It is improving, but there are still challenges there. I think we've also got challenges around how we then use data. So we work with and subscribe to a number of commercial data providers. Now, some of that data is objective data. They're simply reporting to us what they've managed to find in terms of company disclosures. And how we then use that is important that we understand where a company has come from and where a company is intending to go, rather than just looking at sort of static cut or static lens at where that company is right now. So we really understand the transition element of how we invest. There's also a series of challenges around subjective data that data providers provide to us. So when you get an ESG score on a particular topic, really understanding how the data provider has constructed that score, what good means, and how we interpret that in terms of how we then build our portfolios and how we then prioritize our engagement. So I think it's probably too trivial to say that the problem with data is just availability. Of course, we'd like more data, but it's also usability, how we then take the data that's provided to us and really ensure that it's contributing to our investment thesis.
So I hear you that there are also issues with actually maybe getting, you know, quality, reliable, raw actually data that you can then rely on while making informed investment decisions. And in that context, what are your thoughts on the latest developments on corporate sustainability reporting at EU and global level? Do you think that would, you know, help to, I would say, address this challenge?
Yeah, I think so. So I think it's worth starting by saying that Europe essentially represents the ceiling when it comes to corporate disclosure, and that Europe has influence beyond Europe's borders. And so while we are starting to see improved disclosure from the SEC in a number of Asian markets in the UK too, it's important to note that they're not anywhere near the quality and quantity of data that we're getting from many of the European companies in which we invest. And therefore, by establishing really high quality standards in terms of disclosure, Europe is not only ensuring that we've got data within Europe, but it's also helping to sort of set a ceiling around what disclosure should look like elsewhere. I think it's also important to put this into the context of some of the non-regulatory initiatives that we're seeing. So we're recording this in early July, and in June we saw the establishment of the first set of ISSB standards, which for us is a really welcome development because it establishes a baseline. So if you think around ISSB being the baseline and some of the European initiatives, perhaps underpinned by work that GRI has undertaken as being the ceiling, we are starting to make progress on how we think about what good quality corporate disclosure looks like. Now, I think there's a few other challenges that the next few years are going to have to resolve over the next few years. So one is how you calibrate that data, and in particular, how you calibrate it against international frameworks. So how do we know whether the human rights policies that are being implemented are sufficient, or the approach to issues such as inequality, gender inequality, wages provision, trade unionization, and so forth? Well, we need some sort of international frameworks that we can calibrate those disclosures to in order to make sure that we're making the right levels of progress. I think we're also seeing complexity around things like activity-based disclosures and the taxonomy in Europe, again setting the ceiling on how we really think about that, and ensuring that taxonomy and what we mean by substantive contribution is really understood by investors and then becomes really very, very much part of their investment thesis. So I think the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive is extremely, extremely welcome. I think there's some really important components that underpin that. It's worth also putting it within the context of all the other disclosure initiatives that we're part of.
Thank you. What are your views on the latest changes introduced by the European Commission to the final first draft set of European sustainability reporting standards that are being consulted on until 7th of July? Do you think that actually there would be merits in having some disclosures considered as always material meaning mandatory, like, for instance, SFDR-related indicators, climate benchmarks-related disclosures, Pillar 3, you know, that banks may have, as well as maybe some core, you know, climate indicators, right? Like, for instance, Scope 3 emissions that you mentioned. Also, for instance, maybe some core social indicators. Do you think there would be merits for that?
So I do, and if I may, I think in some respects that's a loaded question, because I think clearly there's a position that EuroCIF, PRI, ITCC and others have taken, which is to say that some of the weakening that we've seen through the political processes of the ESRS disclosure mechanisms is counterintuitive to Europe's broader sustainability agenda. And providing clarity to the market around materiality is really important, because one company may interpret it in a different way to another company, and then we're back to that same challenge of lack of comparability. And also it incentivizes companies not to undertake disclosure if they feel that there's costs associated with it, or there's implications for the interaction that they then have with their investors. So more clarity on that actually could lead to market efficiencies. It certainly raises the playing field. It rewards for first movers, and most importantly helps us make progress towards our sustainability goals. So we are supportive, and we've signed the letter that EuroCIF and others have put together in order to give European policymakers confidence around that. But I think it's also important that we are in a challenging geopolitical environment, that we do understand that there are real politic issues here, where companies are struggling with the volume of reporting requirements. They are seeing that there's costs involved in that, and they are seeing that there's challenges in meeting some of the Europe's sustainability objectives, where markets elsewhere are not requiring that, and so there's a premium to doing business here in Europe, and we're certainly cognizant of that. I think we'd argue that's a trajectory, and as I said, Europe's succeeding here, and we do want to see leadership from Europe and other markets. We think we'll catch up. So while there may be a near term cost implication, our expectation is that will even up in the years ahead.
Great. And do you think, in the context actually of that need to, I would say, evolve the sustainability reporting framework also beyond Europe, do you think it would be useful that ISB further develops standards also covering human rights and other social issues, as well as on biodiversity?
Yeah, I do. So I think you've got four main mechanisms here. So one is the voluntary frameworks, as you said, ISSB, and we've seen the overall disclosure standard, and we've seen the climate disclosure standard. But we need other sustainability issues to very quickly follow suit. So that's kind of one lever. The second lever is the way in which international capital works and international companies work. So if they're having to disclose in Europe, or they have European investors, and Europe is requiring a series of additional disclosure obligations, then it may be easier just to disclose at company level, or to disclose across their full business operations, even if some of those business operations sit outside of Europe. A third lever is the way in which Europe uses extraterritoriality mechanisms, such as the carbon border adjustments mechanism, so that it's important that it's not simply cheaper for companies to move their business from Europe and set up elsewhere. And then I think the fourth is just how we think about raising standards here, and in collaboration, and the very important role that Europe plays in that. So international platform and sustainable finance is a good example, but also Europe is obvious is often the acts as a way of working between both China and the US, and provides a sort of communication mechanism, if you like, that can allow international markets to really collaborate on these issues. I think Europe's played that role quite well in the past, and I think arguably needs to put more focus into that in the months and years ahead.
Thank you. And now, switching to a different, however related, topic, what do you think about the currently negotiated Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, the so-called CSDDD? And in particular, what do you think we need actually binding net zero targets and transition plans and corporate due diligence through value chain for large companies? And Also, what do you think about the provision on linking a proportion of directors' variable remuneration with sustainability targets? Do you think that is, you know, a form of an incentive we actually need for the capital markets, you know, to, I would say, better deliver on sustainability objectives?
Goodness, lots of questions there in one, Alexandra. I think so on CSDDD, I mean, I first would acknowledge that it's not a deep area of expertise for me, but there are a couple of components of the directive that I do think are quite interesting. One is the way in which regulators are thinking around due diligence and shifting, if you like, the burden of responsibility from the supervisory authority to the private actor. And while in some instances I think that can be a helpful tool or lever that a regulator or policymaker can use, it does need to be taken with care. And it's important that the regulator isn't saying, look, we don't really know how to regulate human rights challenges in supply chains. And so essentially we're going to just let companies and indeed investors figure that out for us, and then we'll scrutinize the disclosure. Because there is a risk that if the company puts up its hand and says, look, we do have some challenges in our supply chains here, then that would incur a negative reaction, which actually we want companies here to be transparent. And there is a little bit of sort of, you know, first mover challenge here, and also ensuring that companies there is a level playing field for the way in which companies operate. So this does need to be taken with some care. And a good example, a sort of parallel example, is how we think about tax. And actually most regulatory authorities have decided that it's very difficult to know exactly how to tax very complicated multi-jurisdictional companies, and so we kind of leave it up to the company, and as a result of that we do have some challenges in tax, and we've got to make sure that the issues around that we've learned from that, we don't then apply that into due diligence frameworks around things like environmental and social challenges. So that's kind of my headline view. The other thing that I think is quite interesting is the concept of transition finance. And so if you look back at the mandate of the current commission and you think about the sort of core things that the commission has delivered as requested by the HLEG, so it's defined sustainability through the taxonomy, it's helped to create transparency through the SFDR, it's provided the tools through the EU Green Bond Standards and benchmarks. And what we're now saying is actually, yeah, but now we need transition financing as well as everything that you've done here. And that then creates a bit of a challenge to all of the instruments that we've currently got and whether those instruments are then working. So I think there is definitely a role for transition finance. We're seeing this actually in the UK a lot more than we are in Europe through the Transition Plan Task Force that was implemented after a COP that took place in Glasgow. And I think we're now starting to see that in Europe, but it's important not, in our view at least, to ensure that that's put into the context of the other sustainable finance initiatives that Europe's introduced. Your last part of the question was on variable remuneration within sustainability targets. And I do have some scepticism here because of the way it's been implemented in the past. And so what we've seen when we've really looked into this is that many of the sustainability targets attached to remuneration have been targets that the company would have met anyway. So in a sense, it's just a way in which to provide some justification around the levels of remuneration. And we've got to be really careful that if we use remuneration as a tool here to try and encourage companies and indeed investors to take more ambitious action on sustainability topics than they would otherwise have done, that the targets are really stretching targets and not just seen as a way to channel the same levels of remuneration through.
Thank you. Indeed, you're making very important points here, also on linking a proportion of directors' variable remuneration with sustainability targets. And in a way, you know, I think it could work as long as it's actually well aligned with the corporate sustainability targets, like, for instance, here the net zero targets. And of course, here we're just talking about a proportion and of directors' variable remuneration, but you know, it also seems like a very sensible thing to do if we're talking about putting financial and sustainability performance on a more equal footing, and you know, kind of create incentives for directors, including executives, to actually pursue those targets. It seems like, I would say, in a way, a no-brainer, but I definitely get your point that I think the challenge with rules overall is that Well, unfortunately, in certain cases, they are treated more as a kind of a mere compliance exercise, right? And this is where we end up in situations maybe which are not really, I would say, up to the standard, or not really, I would say, in delivering the intended results. Although, for instance, you know, a kind of an interesting anecdote, when I was speaking at one of the conferences in Central Eastern Europe, and actually one of the speakers from a private equity firm, which is apparently leading on actually sustainability in the region, mentioned that actually they have this kind of actually targets and incentives in the remuneration of fund managers, and that they already do that. I mean, what are your views on that?
Yeah, so again, I think if undertaken well, then it can be an important lever. Like, I guess the challenge with variable remuneration touches the sustainability targets, and you mentioned net zero targets, is that net zero targets can be 10, 15 years into the future. And so maybe the way that we can think about this is to ensure that CEOs and directors have some form of financial attachment to the company over that kind of period, and that the company's decarbonization objectives match the way in which they're then personally remunerated, rather than much nearer term targets that we've seen so far that I think can be easily met. And agree, I mean, we within our own variable remuneration requirements within our own company also think around how the portfolio manager has made a contribution to our ESG and sustainability objectives. So certainly would see some benefits of applying this within the investment community too.
Great. And indeed, you know, I definitely get the point about, you know, kind of the length of the period of time during which actually certain targets are to be achieved. However, actually, in this context, this is also what is already to some extent also reflected in the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. Yes. And European Sustainability Reporting Standards, because indeed, you know, even if we talk actually about the corporate disclosures, I mean, in the context of actually the targets and transition plans, I mean, they need to be broken down into actually, you know, time intervals, and ideally those should be actually aligned between the companies, right? So speaking about, for instance, yes, target until 2030, 2050, but then in the meantime, you know, looking at maximum like 5-year periods, so that eventually we can also ensure comparability for the investors and other information users. Now, you mentioned the importance of transition finance. You mentioned also that, well, UK maybe has made some more efforts there than the EU. Although I'd like to challenge you a little bit on that, especially that actually we've done quite a lot of work on that, I think, in the EU on transition plans and climate targets, well, in the context actually of Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, but also Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive and the European Sustainability Reporting Standards. But of course, you know, more can be done. I mean, in this context, also the Platform on Sustainable Finance has given quite some thinking into to what extent also EU taxonomy could be leveraged even further to also contribute to transition investments. So looking at all of that, what do you think are the core components, essential elements, and how the European framework could be improved, or what is it missing in order to unleash the power of transition finance?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important question, and I certainly don't have all the answers, but here's a few things that we're thinking about. So I think first is that the tools that we currently have help us define substantial contribution. That's with the EU Green Bond Standards, underpinned by the taxonomy. The taxonomy thresholds themselves set out substantial contribution. The bit that we can make further progress on within Europe is understanding how we can channel capital to companies that are genuinely transitioning at the fastest pace that is reasonable in terms of the implications on their workers and the communities in which they operate, and the costs that they're having to manage and deal with, and do so in a way that makes sense for the end investor. Now, there's a few things that we can do, I think, to help try and get us there. The first is around stewardship. So I've never understood why stewardship is under the remit of DG Justice and not FSMA. And then the challenges of not connecting some of our sustainable finance tools with the way in which investors then can use their leverage through stewardship, through engagement, through voting, through filing resolutions and through escalation in a way that then meets the objectives of the sustainable finance unit within FSMA. And so a lot more focus, I think, is needed from DG Justice within the next commission on how to really ensure that the Shareholder Rights Directive is really working to incentivize high quality, high conviction stewardship on sustainability topics. I think that's one obvious area that we'd like to see in the coming months. And the other areas around transition disclosures and ensuring that investors are really able to understand, because investors might not have the deep expertise in all of the industries in which they invest and all of the companies within all of those industries to really understand what is a quality transition plan and what's not, and how to differentiate there. I think one other challenge that needs to be thought through that I don't have a solution for is how to then make transition finance accessible for a retail investor. I think within institutional investors, there generally are decision makers that understand the benefits of transition and how to apply transition within investment. It's much harder to explain to a retail saver why they might be invested in what on the surface looks like a polluting industry or company, but actually the rationale for their investment is that company is taking the required steps to decommission high carbon assets or transition their business operations and so forth. So I think I, as I said, don't have all the answers here, and I think that both UK and Europe can really learn from each other and the approaches that they've taken. But those three areas of stewardship, disclosure, and then making it accessible to retail investments is where I'd start.
Great. Now, moving on to the sustainable finance disclosure regulation that, has been a kind of a hot topic over the last years. And, in UK, you've had your own regulatory developments on the so-called SDR. And so I don't know, what are your views on, on what needs to be maybe adjusted or improved in the sustainable finance disclosure regulation in the EU? Today we actually have the deadline to the European Supervisory Authorities consultation on the review of level 2 measures, the regulatory technical standards. However, feel free to also comment on the kind of a broader, needs in terms of reviewing this regulation and also how to maybe better serve it transition investments.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm sure if listeners have made it this far into the podcast, they'll understand SFDR and SDR, but here's my interpretation. So SFDR is a disclosure regime. Essentially, there's three types of disclosure. If you don't really do very much on sustainability, you don't really disclose very much. If you do a bit on sustainability, then you disclose a bit more. And if you do a lot on sustainability, particularly with a focus on impact, then you disclose more still. And those are labelled as Article 6, 8 and 9, although the Commission will be quick to reprimand me and tell me they're not labels but just the articles that determine the level of disclosure. In the UK, it's a slightly different approach in that they brought together disclosure and labeling, and rather than use terminology that implies 9 is better than 8 is better than 6, essentially there's three types of fund proposal. One is what's called focus, where the investor invests in companies that have good sustainability characteristics in place. One is called improvers or transition, where the investor invests in companies that currently don't but have the potential to, and then uses things like stewardship in order to improve those companies. And then one is impact, where there's a very clear intention to deliver sustainability impact. And critically, the FCA, which oversees the SDRs, is saying no one strategy is better than the other, that actually you can achieve real world impact through all three strategies. It depends where you are in the investment cycle that enables you to achieve that impact. Now, in terms of what's next, I think in some respects, we do need to let the regulation settle. And we do need to allow the Commission time to really assess whether the regulation was meeting its aims. I would like to see improved cooperation and collaboration between the European Supervisory Authorities and the Commission, so that we really get the alignment between labelling and disclosure, and that provides a bit of clarity to the market. And then I think as an investment industry, we need to get clear on how we define what we mean by sustainable. And actually, we've got very different interpretations of that. And that really does challenge the purpose of the regulation. So we do need to see more, in my view, we do need to coalesce around a clearer and more easily understood interpretations of how we define sustainable.
And do you think there could be merits in, for instance, adding minimum criteria to SFDR to kind of, I would say, complement the existing categories? Because, you know, right now, in a way, part of the criticism against SFDR is that it's a little bit, you know, in between of a kind of a disclosure regulation and in between of a kind of a standard. So do you think this is a time where we could just, you know, should leave it as a kind of a pure disclosure based regulation and then maybe complement it with some labels? Or do you think actually we could go this, you know, step further and say, okay, fine, we just, you know, complement it with a set of minimum criteria and maybe consider creating one more category that would be more tailored towards transition investments and turn it into a de facto standard?
So I think the suggestion is a good one, but these changes to SFDR have implications. So one is cost. Every time we make changes, investors have to understand those changes. They have to change their disclosures, potentially even change the whether the fund is an Article 8 or an Article 9 fund. There's costs involved in that, and these costs are not insignificant. They're ultimately borne by the end saver. We need to understand the implications of that. So that's kind of one set of challenges. The other set of challenges, and it links your earlier questions around transition finance, is that the current SFDR is a static cut based on a set of disclosures that we use predominantly from third-party providers in order to determine how we understand the sustainability characteristics of the fund. They don't tell us much about the transition elements of the companies within the fund. And if we were to introduce minimum sustainability requirements, then that doesn't address that transition and that static cut, that sort of window at a point in time approach. I think also, and it links back to the comment I made earlier around the importance in my mind around stewardship, is that it's important that we accompany a disclosure with a narrative. So the disclosure might say that 70% of the companies we classify as sustainable, whatever percentage it might be. But unless it's accompanied by a narrative, it's very difficult to know what is the additionality that we can apply to the investor. And if it says 70% is sustainable, but actually we're really engaging this 30% and we want to see that 30% decrease to 15% within the next 3 years and here are our targets and so forth, then arguably that's a more useful set of disclosures than a set of minimum criteria. So I think I'd probably push back a little bit on you, not necessarily saying that the proposal is a bad one, but it needs to be understood in the context of the points I've just made.
Great. And maybe just pausing also for a second on the principal adverse impact indicators that have been also quite broadly debated and are currently, well, still today consulted on. In particular, there has been some criticism that the principal adverse impact indicators to date are, you know, focus mostly on the environmental aspects, while the social indicators have been much more, I would say, limited. Do you have any views on how to maybe improve the social indicators? I mean, do you think there is a need to, for instance, improve social indicators in the SFDR RTSs, in particular, to effectively contribute to reducing human rights abuses, inadequate working conditions, and social inequalities?
Yes, it's a really good question and an important question. I think there's two parts to it. So one is the principal adverse indicators themselves and are they working? And I think it's important to put this in the context of sort of 400 years here of financial regulation. This is one of the first attempts that regulators have taken not to regulate the financial performance of the investment activity or even the processes that underpin the investment activity, but the outcomes, the real world impact of the investment activity, and really to require the investor to understand that real world impact, to disclose on that real world impact, and then to take mitigating steps to address that real-world impact. And that's quite a shift. It's quite a conceptual change in how we think about financial regulation, conceptual change that we really welcome. But it inevitably, when something like that happens, there's going to be some challenges with the implementation, and there's going to be some back and forth on how to get this to work exactly as it was what was intended. And so I don't think we need to worry too much about some of the noise that we've seen around principal adverse impact indicators in the near term. The second part of the question on the role of social indicators is another interesting one, because I think that's essentially a consequence of the focus on social issues more broadly. And social issues, I mean, a good example is a taxonomy, and that is tackled climate mitigation, adaptation, other environmental themes, and only now is it really starting to think about social factors. In the UK, we've seen climate disclosure requirements for pension schemes, whereas social issues were almost in the too hard to deal with bucket. So the DWP, the Pensions Ministry, just created a task force rather than mandating disclosures. We didn't really know how to tackle them. And social issues are personal. Your definition of inequality might be different from mine. Political, certain social issues are attached to certain political parties in a way that we don't really get quite to the same extent with climate change. They tend to be difficult to measure. The link to financial materiality is that much harder to prove. And so there's a series of challenges around social issues. I think that we're just seeing that play out in the way in which the principal adverse impact indicators have been constructed.
Thank you. To finish off our discussion, what are your views on further developing the sustainable finance agenda in the EU, even beyond? I mean, I think you've mentioned already quite a lot about, you know, what might be, you know, done to further improve actually the sustainable finance agenda. But yeah, what do you think should be, I would say, the key three priorities pursued by the next commission?
Yeah, so I find that quite difficult to answer. I think it's important to put into the geopolitical context. So we've obviously seen a bit of a pushback on responsible investment, particularly in the US. We have the very unique challenges to energy markets and energy security caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We have, for the last 10 years of responsible investment, essentially been in a low interest rate environment. And now, particularly in UK and Europe, we're now in a high interest rate environment. There's going to be far more focus on financial performance and how that fits with responsible investments. There's a series of challenges that we're facing that I think are quite real. In terms of the next set of steps, so I think connection with real economy. So your very first question was on the challenges and ensuring that the real economy is making the progress that it needs to. Otherwise, as investors, we're seeking to plug gaps in the real economy rather than use financing in order to expedite changes already underway in the real economy. Stewardship, I've mentioned. Importance of the international collaboration, I've mentioned. And also just to make sure that the transition financing element is working well, and also to make sure the implementation has some time to settle. There's been some, you know, it's a nascent industry still, and there's been some quite considerable change in the last few years. We need to check whether it's working. We need to really assess the progress that we've made, decide on the bits that are successful, the bits that are less so, and seek to address where we need to. So definitely the next European Commission will have its hands full, I think, on sustainable finance. But it's those sort of three or four areas is where I'd like to see focus.
Great. Thank you very much, Will, for joining us today and for this insightful conversation and for your time.
Thank you.